And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Welcome to year 11 of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, Dean Haglund.
Good Lord, when you put it like that, sounds like we're just slogging it out in a gulag.
Last week was our 10th anniversary show.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean, during the past couple weeks, we said goodbye to Oscar-winning filmmaker Jonathan Demme.
Yes. That was a surprise.
He died at 73 of esophageal cancer and heart disease. I guess he had kept the cancer somewhat secret from people for quite a while. But, you know, he had a movie come out last year or the year before, Ricky and the Flash. He'd been working.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
it always is surprising, I guess, when these guys seem to us to just suddenly die on us.
Right, exactly. You had no idea it was coming.
And well, the thing with Demme dying is it was in a strange way doubly sad because it also made me recall and to a certain degree relive Jonathan Demme's nephew Ted Demme dying mm-hmm. in 2002 at the very young age of 38. And I really thought that Ted Demme might. If not achieve the legacy, certainly of his uncle, nevertheless carve out an indelible one for himself. I thought his movie The Ref, starring Judy Davis and Kevin Spacey and Dennis Leary, is really one of the underrated comedies of the last few decades.
Right. Yeah. I in fact, didn't see it. So that's how far
well, you
underrated
might wanna,
it is.
You might want to check that out. It's really good. It's the one that let everyone know that Dennis Leary could act. Anyway, that's Ted Demme. And, of course, Jonathan Demme begins as an independent filmmaker working on Corman-esque projects, not just Corman projects, but Corman-esque projects in the 1970s. He really, I think, first gains, if not mainstream acceptance, then certainly credibility with the critically acclaimed Last Embrace, a modern Hitchcockian kind of thriller starring Roy Scheider that was, I think, 1979. I saw it in film school and was just blown away by this movie.
Right.
It was the kind of movie that, at his best, Brian De Palma was making, but that Brian De Palma was always aspiring to. And Jonathan Demme then the next year goes on to make the Oscar-nominated Melvin and Howard. But this guy worked in a lot of different genres, and including among those, documentary. Think about his 1980s documentary, Stop Making Sense, that really brought the Talking Heads to a much wider audience.
Yeah, and it was conceptually so great, right? Because it had just one musician, then two musicians, that each song built. And I think it was the first time where you actually could see the director's thought put into how we're going to stage a concert as opposed to just sticking a camera in the middle of the audience and filming a concert.
And how about his other documentary, Swimming to Cambodia?
Spalding Gray.
Spalding Gray's one-man show and, translated to the screen by Jonathan Demme. Those are indelible 1980s documentaries. And interestingly enough, both of them were parodied, I guess you could say, on the show that I love, Documentary Now, the Fred Armisen, Seth Meyers, Bill Hader show. I guess you could say parodied because the love, but this is true, right? For a parody to be effective,
yeah.
it has to, the makers of that parody have to really love what they're parodying. And sure enough, the love really comes through the these parodies. And I guess I say sort of parodying because they're more parodying the personalities of the figures at the center of Jonathan Demme's documentaries. They're not parodying Jonathan Demme's approach in any way.
Right. So, yeah. And yet they're matching it. So it feels like a Jonathan Demme documentary.
It really...
Because I finally caught one of these things.
Which one did you see? Which one did you see?
The one that parodies the black and white still photographs, Robert Evans thing.
Oh, yes. The kid stays in the picture.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kid stays in the picture.
You have so much to look forward to. I mean, when you get to the Euro Dreams of Sushi parody, I mean, there is just... and they love these movies, like I said. But so then we move into Jonathan Demme's narrative work in the 80s. How about Something Wild, which continues to be a cult favorite. Melanie Griffith, Jeff Daniels, such a delightful dark comedy. You've got Married to the Mob, which, unless I'm very much mistaken, gives Michelle Pfeiffer one of her best roles, actually.
I think so, yeah.
And,
yeah, really doing a character.
And you have The Silence of the Lambs. So these are... you know, in close proximity to each other there in the late 80s, early 90s. And what do they all have in common? Well, they all have a certain darkness to them. And they all feature very unique, very real, very compelling female lead performances.
Ah, isn't that true? Now you mention it.
He follows up Silence of the Lambs with Philadelphia, which is another Oscar-winning film, wins Tom Hanks his first Oscar. So quite a legacy on the big screen for Jonathan Demme. I would be remiss if I did not express my personal appreciation for the man who booked my film, Carl Rove, I Love You, into his very own theater in New York. In fact, not only did he book the film, he wrote a review of the film in which he called Carl Rove, I Love You, an all-around first-class ensemble act of collective imagination brought to life in a totally original film, as indie and often as funny as it gets. He was a big fan of Dan Butler, who, of course, was in The Silence of the Lambs. So a very sad farewell to the great Jonathan Demme.
Yeah.
Hey, did you get a chance to listen to the 10th anniversary show of this, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour?
I certainly did. And was I shocked at how much I sound like my voice is aging.
That's what you got out of it, did you? I found myself listening to it several times. I really, really enjoyed it. First of all, the reviews are in, and it's a great show. According to certainly our friend Mark Hirschhorn, who wrote a lovely article about the show for Splitsider. So thank you to Mark, and thank you for everybody who's let us know about it. And by the way, I would be remiss in speaking about our 10th anniversary if I did not extend birthday wishes, many happy returns, to Alana Rain, whose birthday is, I believe, today. And, and of course, she was featured in a clip from the first hour of the Mayan Podcastathon, which was one of your 10 most memorable episodes you talked about in our 10th anniversary show.
Right. Though it's now a fever dream. But yes, it was memorable for sure.
But I loved it. I loved that clip even because it showed me, as did several other clips in the show, but it showed me how wonderful it is when you usurp the soapbox from me and get up on it.
Well, it does happen occasionally, but, you know.
Yeah, and it's fun. And I mean, the thing is that I can kind of generate a rant about almost anything. You have to actually...
Right, because you're an angry old man.
You have to actually... I am a bit of a town crier. A bit of an agent provocateur. You really need to feel it. And I loved the rant that we played a little clip from about, you know, the end of the Mayan calendar. And why does it have to be the end of the world? Why can't it be the beginning of the world?
Yeah. And we saw how that went. So I was way off.
Well, you know, transitions are not finite things, right?
That's true.
The lifting of the veil, it's a big veil. It might take a while for some people. Right. Right?
And we may only see it in, you know, in hindsight. Look, it's hard to see the trees for the forests,
exactly,
and vice versa.
All you need to do is look at a decade's fashion to realize that, right? You're sitting
there,
right, in the middle of a decade thinking to yourself, well, this decade has no unique fashion for itself. And, you know, last decade didn't. And then you watch sitcom reruns of last decade's show, and you go, oh, yeah, last decade really did have a style. But, I think it's shocking for people who came of age to the 90s to realize how distinctive and really bad 90s fashion were, in a way that the 80s were not. The 80s were crazy in their fashion, but still seemed,
right,
fun. The 90s, just nothing fun about it at all. But the interesting thing about it, right, is it isn't, you don't drop the hammer right on the beginning of the decade. The early part of a decade always looks a little bit like the decade that preceded it. So, if the veil of fashion takes a little while to to lift, then certainly the veil of awakening to the dream of the world and becoming conscious co-creators with our environment might take a little bit of time.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That cheers me up then.
Well, I am going to attempt to be cheery and optimistic on this week's show, though don't kid yourself, I've got a lot of beefs I want to get to. But first,
right,
one of the things that I loved in hearing, and this actually ironically fills me with optimism and makes me want to keep doing this show, I loved in listening to some of those clips how often we were wrong. because I picked a clip from when we were driving to Malibu intentionally because we got into this really good rant that we would repeat from time to time and explore. But that was the first time we really got into depth about it, which is about how everything in Hollywood is based on risk management. And we were really, you know, railing against the man for this kind,
right,
of methodology. And yet, what I loved was how many of the examples we used of what they were developing would actually turn out not to be crap, but really, really great. In some cases, true works of art. Like, we were so dogging the Mad Max that was in development without Mel Gibson.
Yeah. Right.
And it turns out to be the best Mad Max of all
of them. The best. Absolutely. It's, you know, I guess George Miller heard that and went, well, I got to really step up my game and make this thing an incredible work of art. And he did. So maybe, you know, our ranting, maybe in some small part, was instrumental in its success.
True. Or maybe it's wise to be a cynic because that way things can only get better. So anything strike you in listening to the anniversary show other than the fact that you sound older apparently?
It's about the scope and breadth of what we've talked about over the years. You know, I forgot how you know, you and Sully McCullough, did I get his last name right?
Yes.
Your friend from Cupertino.
Sully McCullough, yes.
Yeah. And how that story was more gripping upon the rehearing of it than it was in the room for some reason. And you know, it's I always think, yeah, you know, we just yak about whatever. But there is actually quite a not just a scope, but a yardstick through society, dare I say, which we are dipping in the to check the oil level of where we're at. That is kind of fascinating.
Well, the depth of these conversations, sometimes the entertainment value of them belies their depth. I actually experienced certainly what you're describing in going back to the Suli conversation, but I kind of expected that because, as I admitted in bringing certain things up, this was the first time in our friendship I'd been able to even address these, so I expected that there would be things discussed in the room that I would also block out. He describes the need to block things out, right? And so it was that moment when he talks about, here's a thing about black people, what black people do. We block things out. You know, it was really powerful to me. And in the moment, it was very funny. It's still funny.
Yeah.
But it's funny and powerful. But also the conversations with Vince Gilligan, just the little clip that we played last week with Tucker Smallwood. Every time I go back to these shows, I'm unpacking more in what these people say. And part of it is because, of course, I've grown. I'm a different person. I can understand things differently. But also, they have moved on in their career and their development, and things that they say really shine a light on where they were heading. So,
right.
So again, the entertainment aspect of it, because they're enjoyable. I mean, I can rarely... I mean, if we ever want to do a show about our 10 least memorable, but how would we remember them? You know? But,
exactly. So I don't remember that at all.
Might there have been conversations that weren't interesting? Maybe. I kind of doubt it because I think we find what's interesting to us and we ask about them, right? So
exactly.
But boy, really, you can go back to these and gain more. It was, you know, it wasn't easy putting that show together in terms of the clips, you know, because there was a certain, I don't know, not weight isn't the right word, because again, how much do people pay for this show? But but you want to reflect in some way why the show might be memorable for us. And hopefully to other people. You want to do justice to it, right? So
exactly.
I really felt the need to listen to them. But what I will say that I did not do is have any plan of, oh, this clip echoes this clip, which leads into this clip. I had no plan of that. I was operating entirely intuitively on based on what we had said about why the show was memorable. And then do I have a clip that either speaks to that or dances alongside it in a nice way. But when I finished listening to the show after editing it together, I went, wow, there are through lines in these clips even that kind of astonished me.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? Well, that means there's a through line in our thought process, isn't it?
Hopefully, but again, it is, I like to think if we can borrow analysis that we apply to what we learned from The Truth Is Out There, I think it's because we try to bring a very conscious approach to our unconscious. Again, we are not writing these shows in terms of thematic through lines ever. Even when I'm taking notes, even when I'm outlining things, even when I'm researching our guests, I in no way am writing questions down. I'm no way going after particular themes. It's topics. But I think we bring a certain conscious approach to how these topics operate on each of us individually in our creative process and our psychic processes.
Right. So
Another way we were wrong, I think, but it also shows, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We were ranting in that Malibu show about how there was going to be another Alien movie. And it turns out to be Prometheus, which is a very interesting kind of movie. And here we are. And in a couple of weeks, we get yet another one. So,
right.
And I have hopes that it's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah. Well, this is Covenant, though. So this is what they're doing now is they're going back to the Dark Horse comic book series, I think, that was there in the 90s. Dave Dorman, some other really cool writers and artists working on these alien standalone novels. And I think they've extracted two or three stories. And I remember putting down some of those graphic novels because they were frightening.
Well, that's good.
Absolutely
that's
terrifying.
Good. This is a sequel. It's a direct sequel to Prometheus. And it is a direct prequel to Alien. So it'll be interesting. I also wonder if there's any ways that it ties in, honestly, to Blade Runner. Because it's become more and more clear that this is the same universe, right? The corporation is that is referred to is, I think, the same. But anyway, I'd be curious about that. So we will see what happens. But I also am struck, again, optimistically, by the more things stay the same, the more they do offer change. We had a Writers Guild of America deal struck with the producers, the motion picture and television producers. There was a deal struck. There was, in fact, no strike. And it seems like, from first blush anyway, I'm sure there's people that are going to complain about it, it seems like a pretty fair deal. It seems like a forward-thinking deal in terms of new media. It seems like they're starting to carve out a way to stay ahead of the ever-changing technology curves in ways that make sense for writers in terms of the time that they spend on things. And also, it makes a lot of sense in terms of human issues like healthcare. And, you know, family leave and issues like this that you would hope that the producers and the writers could come together on. Because, again, when we describe producers, what we mean are conglomerates. We mean corporations.
Right.
But they're corporations engaged in the creation of entertainment and storytelling. And I would like to think that we could find that kind of common ground in those negotiations that maybe, God willing, could point the way, I don't know, for negotiations in other parts of the country.
Right. That one can see this as a harbinger, a model, a perhaps template of somewhere going forward somehow.
Hopefully. Wouldn't that be...
Well, yes.
Wouldn't that be lovely? Please.
I'm always reading about how robots are going to take over now 30% of the jobs in the next 10 years, that it's already there, ready to go. And it's basically going to give every state in the union a haircut in terms of how much capital, how much spending money will be in circulation. Because any job that's under $10 an hour can be replaced by an artificial intelligent robot, and there would all the unemployment and available cash would go out the window, and the corporations would just use that in terms of stock dividends.
The optimistic side of that is that people can't survive on those jobs anyway. What we need to create are better jobs. An economy of the future is one where everyone is maximizing their human potential, and that requires the responsibility on the part of people to educate themselves, to ever grow, to ever learn, right? And at the same time, models for healthy, this is the optimistic side, right? A renewable economy. one that renews all its resources. And I'm not just talking about energy. I'm talking about energy in all its forms, energy expended by its workforce, energy in terms of currency, all these things, instead of looking at it the old way, which is about just economic growth, right? Like a cancer,
right.
It needs to be constant. A renewable economy is one where the energy of the workforce is renewed as well. The spirit of the workforce is renewed as well, and there's opportunity there for that. The negative side of that is, oh, dear Lord, we will go backwards so fast in terms of energy and, technology, ironically, by using robots, because there are certain... Like, for example, how about suddenly with robots? Yeah, we'll open those coal mines again because
now we
don't have to pay anyone and there isn't any health problem for the robots.
Exactly. Well, and that's happening here in Australia. The first company to be using automated driving vehicles guided by GPS is going to be the mining industry with those giant six-story dump trucks. They're already placed orders and are testing them now in the open pits, because before it would, you'd have to pay a guy to sit there and drive 12 hours a day back and forth for no other, there's no curves, there's no other traffic. It's a mind-numbing job that's hard on the body. And yeah, absolutely, if they can not have to pay somebody $160,000 a year to sit and drive one of those trucks back and forth, they're going to do it. And it's, a guy who's now, his body won't be killing him when he retires at the age of 50.
I have found no end of reason, if I wanted to be pessimistic this week. What a strange, strange week it was. First of all, Dean, to find myself on UK radio at midnight on Wednesday, 8 a.m. UK time, doing my fairly regular weather report for Siren FM. What I found was I had to actually do quite a bit of the show itself, not just the weather report, because several guests had to, or regular contributors, had to miss the show because they were standing by for CNN or other media outlets to conduct interviews with. In the wake of an emergency meeting that was announced by the royal family.
Oh, yes.
And, of course,
yes.
Everything went into panic mode. Oh, my goodness, Prince Philip is dead. Oh, my goodness, the Queen is abdicating. And, of course, neither of these things came to pass. The big emergency session, it was a meeting of the household staff, because the household... And when they say household staff, they don't just mean at Buckingham. They mean all royal residences have to hightail immediately during the night to London, to Buckingham, from Balmoral in Scotland, for example, from Wales. All of them have to get there for this staff meeting, basically to learn that Prince Philip is retiring at age 96. He's retiring from something like 600 organizations he participates in. So that was the announcement. But what was odd for me was to be on the UK radio at this and everyone being so calm. Two things were odd. First of all, they all knew, apparently, or many members of the media did, what the announcement was going to be. But out of deference to the royal family, the media does not reveal what that announcement will be until the royal family announces it. Can you imagine an American press showing that kind of deference to anyone or anything? I can't.
No. No.
And then the other thing that was so odd about it was to find how nervous I myself was. Like, I had never thought I cared really about the royal family, but I didn't want the Queen to be abdicating. I didn't want Prince Philip to be dead. I found that I was emotionally invested in a very odd way.
Wow. What's that about? I never knew you to be a royal watcher at all.
Yeah, no, I'm really, really not. So it surprised me. But I think it has something to do with the stability that she represents and has represented for so long, and also her dedication to service. I mean, she always said that she would spend her entire life in service to her people, which means not abdicating,
right.
not stepping down, much like her father did. So
right.
I guess I was surprised to find this out in some respects, but maybe I should not have been, that a passage of history or the prospect of that would affect me. At the same time, it also, you know, was odd because here's this going on, and meanwhile we're inundated with stupid memes about Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. Or as I like to call it, and as we really should when we make it an official holiday, Death to Culture Day.
As the series represents.
Hey, I loved our friend Matty Giles did a great post, though, where he ranked the quality of the Star Wars films, and he had A New Hope episode 4, the first one, really low, which I'm sure would get a lot of criticism drawn his way. But what I loved about it was the best of the Star Wars films. What did he have ranked number one? Hidden Fortress by Akira Kurosawa. Which, of course,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, Star Wars ripped off, borrowed
exactly.
from, whatever. But before I make it seem like I'm way too down on the kids and their slavish devotion to really shitty storytelling, can I instead direct more animosity towards people's embrace of Cinco de Mayo?
Okay.
If you are not, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build a border wall around that holiday. This way, if you are not of Mexican heritage, okay, and on May 3rd, you are making posts about celebrating early Cinco de Mayos, you have to stop it right now, and you have to just say, I'm getting drunk on a work night. That's what you have to post. You cannot write it off as celebrating an early Cinco de Mayo. You know, look, if Cinco de Mayo is important to your heritage, to your community, God bless you. I salute you and your desire to celebrate that which is important to you. To people who look like me, right? It's just a night for amateurs to get drunk. That's what it is.
Okay. But I'm going to attest. I'm going to contradict you. Let's see. Here's my reason, Dietra, why we should all celebrate Cinco de Mayo. Growing up in Canada, the cultural mosaic that it is, we had a little festival called Folklorama.
If you could have heard me with my, the microphone was down, but if you could have heard me, you would have known that made me giggle, the cultural mosaic that is Canada, which is actually a fairly fascinating segue into the next topic, but please continue about the cultural mosaic.
In that we're not a melting pot, that we encourage every culture to keep a lot of their traditions and heritage as a way to make up a country so that when you stand back, it's a beautiful mosaic and not a big pile of melted goo that's all one color or one cultural whatever. So to celebrate that, there was a week-long festival called Folklorama where every culture got a high school and they had the beer from their country, the music from their country, and it was an excuse to go every night. The buses would be free and you could go drinking in any country you want, theoretically. You got a little passport. You got stamped at these little passports. You tried to see as many of these things. And then at the same time, they would show some art and some dance from these things. But mostly it was an excuse for all of Winnipeg to drink foreign beers all over high schools. So again, did we learn a lot about other cultures? Absolutely. I would have never known about steel drum tuning from Jamaica had I not gone to the Jamaican Pavilion. However, is this a way of saying it's amateurs getting drunk on a school night, and it should only be for those who are of that heritage. I disagree. I think there is a way of having a celebration like Cinco de Mayo as a way to learn about a culture and at the same time get drunk on a school night. So
okay, but you are not telling me that Cinco de Mayo celebrations that you have witnessed in Los Angeles really teach anything about the culture to, again, people who look like me. And I don't mean the virile, handsome, balding people. I mean white folks. I guarantee you, if we went around asking most people, white people who are celebrating Cinco de Mayo, what Cinco de Mayo is celebrating, they would not be able to tell us. Okay, but more than that, can we agree then? This is about the negotiation that we're, the optimism we're trying to show. Maybe we can come to a certain consensus through negotiation that we can adopt the following policy. Let me make this policy suggestion, Dean, that you are banned as a white person from celebrating Cinco de Mayo unless you resist the border wall and the racist rhetoric of the current White House administration. How about that? If you resist those things, then drink up, my friend.
Well, see there. Now that's a way to celebrate it. Absolutely. We stop that which divides us and we embrace that which brings us together.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what Cinco de Mayo should be.
But again, what a strange week. Royal family, Star Wars Day, Cinco de Mayo, and then quite seriously, I mean, if these things weren't so ludicrous, they would be, well, I mean, again, the entertainment value of these things belies how terrifying they truly are, and that is the attacks on the First Amendment that are being waged right now, and I give you two examples that I'm sure you might be aware of how freedom of political speech and protest is under attack by the current administration. Case one is 61-year-old protester Desiree Ferruz, who was convicted and is facing 1 year in jail after laughing in response to a comment made by a senator during then Attorney General nominee and fellow senator Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearings. In the audience, Desiree Ferruz giggled and was charged with being basically in contempt of the congressional hearing. And the giggle, do you know what prompted her to giggle?
Well, yeah, the guy was blowing smoke up Jeff Sessions' ass. That was clearly not true.
Well, and it was I think everyone wants to make it be about her laughing. This is the first problem I have. Everyone makes it be about her laughing at Jeff Sessions, which honestly,
I don't think it was.
That could be fine. But she laughed at the comment, like you said, blowing smoke up, where Senator Shelby said that in his long career, there could be no doubt that Jeff Sessions would treat all equally under the law. What was funny about this to Desiree Ferruz, and to me, if it wasn't so just nauseating, was that Senator Shelby himself ran an attack ad against Jeff Sessions, saying he was basically a Klansman.
Right. So that should get a chortle in its irony.
Yes.
Is this attack on irony?
Exactly. We cannot appreciate the irony. I mean, we have to pretend the stench of the bullshit that is being thrown around by the monkeys in both chambers of our legislative body has no stink. That's what you were expected to pretend now. Like,
please. But what's the outcome? Has she been actually charged? Is she doing
no, she was convicted. Now we're awaiting sentencing.
Oh, yeah. She was convicted.
Yeah. And that alone sends, whether she goes to jail, whether this 61-year-old woman does a year of hard time or not, the scary message has been sent. The threat has been sent. Okay. Case two, and then we'll dial it back to how this administration is unique in their approach to these things. Stephen Colbert is being investigated by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, for homophobic slurs that he uttered in a rant responding to our president's insulting appearance on Face the Nation, where our president directly insulted and was derogatory towards the man interviewing him. The man interviewing him would not respond in kind. He maintained his decorum. A friend of his, Stephen Colbert, had had enough and went on an epic rant looking at the accomplishments of the first 100 days of the Trump administration. And when he got to the point where he said the only thing Trump's mouth is good for is as a cock holster for Vladimir Putin's penis, people on the right got outraged, saying that is virulently homophobic.
Well, not
people
really.
People have not understood Stephen Colbert's unapologetic explanation of this. So please, people, listen to me. All right? Because no one is more sensitive to groups that are prone to bullying than your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness. So if there was a whiff of homophobia in this, yeah, I would have a problem with it, as I have had in the past with other comedians and hosts. There is nothing he said that that impugns the act of oral sex. There is nothing that he says that impugns man-on-man oral sex. The problem he is indicating is not with having a penis in your mouth, but using your mouth as a cock holster for an enemy of the state. That's the problem. It's not that Donald Trump wants to blow other men. We salute that ideal because at least it's a loving act. We like to think that our president has love in his heart and in his mouth. But there are suitable sexual partners and there are unsuitable sexual partners, and they are not defined by gender. They are defined by whether sleeping with them is an act of being a traitor. That's the point of the joke. And the FCC is waging a full-scale investigation into Stephen Colbert.
Well, what are they going to... I mean, the FCC is just about... they beep out swear words. They don't really have a say in content, do they?
Well, they haven't. The White House has made it very clear that their intention is to rewrite libel and slander laws. And I think the First Amendment is very much legally going to be under attack. It is going to be held up to legal challenge. So the battle lines are drawn. And I would just like to point out this. About our administration. You know, the adage of the previous administration was when your opponents go low, you go high, right? You try to maintain the high road. This current administration, when people go low, they get even more petty and even lower. And, become all the more repellent. I would never criticize anyone for voting for Donald Trump. I really wouldn't. I don't have it in me to criticize people for their choices in that regard. My criticism is entirely to the fact that this man is virulent. He is incompetent. He is mentally ill. He is small. He is insignificant. And we are all paying the price of this.
Absolutely. So, what solution do we offer? None. Other than,
but why am I optimistic? Why am I optimistic, Dean Haglund? Because it was Orson Welles' birthday this week. It was not the week of Star Wars Day. It was not the week of the attacks on the First Amendment. It was the week where we celebrate the birth of Orson Welles, perhaps the greatest genius in the art form of filmmaking, a man who made such an impact in so many other art forms as well. I celebrated this week, Dean, by watching for the first time ever the final feature film that he completed in his lifetime and the shortest feature film that he made, 58 minutes long, and the only feature film that he made in color called The Immortal Story. It was an adaptation of a short story by Karen Blixen. That was her pen name. She's become known in later years, especially because of Out of Africa, for her real name, Isaac Dinesen. It is a really...
Whom my grandmother communicated with, by the way.
Oh.
Yes, well, you might, they were friends.
You might find this fascinating because it isn't a great movie. In some ways, you're watching this movie going, well, this is almost ridiculous. This is so weird, it's almost bad. And yet at some point, I realized I'm not watching a movie. I'm literally experiencing what it's like to walk around inside a Karen Blixen story.
Oh, that's pretty neat. And it's called, again, The Immortal...
The Immortal Story. It's a...
Story.
It's about another one in a long line of Wellesian kind of Citizen Kane figures, rich, powerful men who are distant from their humanity. Boy, that doesn't strike a chord at all with what's going on today. And this man using his power, his singular power, to make a story played out because he hates that this story that he heard was fictional and he wants this story to become factual for at least one person. So he manipulates things to make it happen. So I celebrated that. It was interesting, again, to watch this and to realize it's his only color film. Welles actually said that color cinematography is better for locations. It's better for production design. It's better for costumes. It's worse for the actors. And he could not name one great screen performance in color. And that's not to say that there have not been. That's to say that in 1968, when he said that, he could not think of one. And honestly, off the top of my head, I was hard-pressed to think of many. Because by 68, there were still, if there were real, certainly into the 60s, if you had a really important film you were making, you might still make it black and white. That was the interesting thing about it.
Exactly. There was still, that was still considered gravitas, epic gravitas in black and white.
I also celebrated Orson Welles' birthday by rewatching Magnificent Ambersons. This is the first time I had seen it in quite a few years. And for people who don't know, everyone knows Citizen Kane, perhaps the greatest film ever made. Magnificent Ambersons was his follow-up. And he gets called away out of the country by our government to make a propaganda film in South America. And while he's there, the studio wrests control away from him. And following a supposedly disastrous screening in Pomona, they decide to butcher the film, cut out 60 minutes, destroy the negative, and tack on a happy ending, which would be directed by turncoat Judas Burning in Hell, Robert Wise, who had edited...
Wow.
Citizen Kane, and would go on to direct, among other things, The Sound of Mucus. So, this movie, what's left of it, is every bit the equal to Citizen Kane, if not even greater. Every single scene it's unbelievable, some of these master takes, Dean, where it's not just the direction and not just the performance and not just the production design, but every single technician is working at the very top of not only their game, but of what filmmakers can do. That's the only way I can describe it, is I became aware in watching it this time, dear God, everyone is doing the best work that anyone in their field had ever done at that point, and maybe ever, because the way we make movies, the technology that we have now to make movies, allows us to be, quite honestly, not as great during the production process, because we have so many more tools at our disposal in the post-production process.
Right. Right. Wow. Okay. Now I have to see this thing. Now, you saw the most completed edit possible of the Magnificent Ambersons?
There is no restoration of it. I saw it on DVD. There was a DVD that was released as a limited edition in the anniversary Blu-ray of Citizen Kane. I was able to get it from a friend at Warner Brothers. It's never been available for commercial release, but there is no restoration. There's just the 88-minute theatrical release. That's all there is. And when it was released, after butchering it and everything, it's the second film. It's the B picture on a double feature with Lupe Velez's Spitfire Sees a Ghost. And but it still gets, despite that and despite how much Hollywood hated Wells, still gets 4 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture.
Wow.
But I segue into a great amount of optimism I actually have for cinema, because we've talked about, and I've talked about in meetings with distributors, how young people don't go to movies anymore.
Right.
And this chase to track them down, to try to get them to come back. And I've been thinking about what will get them to come back. And I've had a lot of meetings, as it pertains to The Lady Killers, about, you know, the economics of distribution and how things are set up and how, you know, these corporations that really are what we call the producers in Hollywood and the distributors in Hollywood, they're in precarious situations, and this is not news to anyone, right? These big corporations keep getting in big financial trouble. But part of it is, and you've seen this with ticket prices. There are some very expensive ticket prices. There are some luxury house theaters and everything. But for the most part, ticket prices have flatlined. And even when they were going up, the adage was they haven't gone up commensurate with inflation in other areas. And in terms of the amount of time of entertainment they give you, they are still the best value for your dollar of any live event, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
The fallacy in that is that it ignores that anything only has value insofar that the people who attend give it value. So you can't say, well, the $16 movie ticket for a 2.5-hour experience is still so much cheaper and therefore better than the ticket to go see a baseball game. Those are completely apples and oranges, and the people who go to those things value them differently. And
right.
So as I've seen the disappearance of young people to movies, understandable, because they have movies at their disposal any way they want. They can watch them on their phones. They can watch them on their tablets. They can watch them on their laptops. They can watch them on TV, right? So
right. They
don't value the movie cinema experience the way that maybe
right. We
think they ought to, or certainly we did when we were their age. So is there any
right. Way
to get them back to that experience? And I would say yes, because, you know, I go to museums quite often. And I didn't when I was the age of the young people we're talking about. But when I go to museums, I see a lot of young people. They go to museums.
Oh.
They value the experience of art. Even if they're going there and spending all their time taking photos that they're posting on social media so that they can prove that they had an experience, they're
right. Going.
They're going. And I maintain, at a time when storytelling, narrative storytelling is getting as good on television as narrative storytelling can get, the future of film is as an art form, not a narrative form. Orson Welles said in the 60s about television, television is great for storytellers, terrible for artists.
Ah.
It's a narrative form, he said, and we are seeing just the excellence of narrative form really coming to being in television. So the need for excellence in narrative is diminished on the big screen, which is where for many decades we found it, right? That was the excellence of the narrative form. But what you have the ability to do on the big screen is to make every image a work of art.
Right. A la Mad Max, the latest of
even
the...
Even in a studio tentpole. Indeed.
Yeah.
We're not talking art house versus multiplex. We're not. We're talking about the form itself. Look at the Oscars recently, right? How about, I wasn't a big fan, obviously, of The Revenant, but that's a work of art, not a work of narrative.
Yeah.
Gravity, a big crowd pleaser, a work of art, not a work of narrative. This year, the Oscars came as close as possible to giving it to a work of narrative, La La Land. But at the last second, literally took it away to give it to a work of art, which was, oh my goodness,
Moonlight.
Moonlight. Thank you.
Moonlight, yeah.
Okay. I could go on and on. Birdman, right? Works of art, not works of narrative. These are what's being rewarded, and they are being rewarded at the box office as well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people are going to look for entertainment. That's not an issue. Art can be wonderfully entertaining. We talked about paintings on this show and other artworks, but a few weeks back, some of the paintings we described are some of the funniest, the scariest, the darkest, the most entertaining works you could imagine.
Yes. However, is there a however?
No, there's not a however. The point is that, some are not going to. Some are going to be challenging. Some are not going to be, quote unquote, entertaining. Some are going to really tax you. Some are going to disturb you. But the point is the future of cinema is as an art form, not perhaps what it once was, which is a mass form of communication, of narrative communication, but as an art form. And as an art form, it might draw mass audiences. But now what needs to happen is the economics surrounding the apparatus that supports and exploits this art form needs to reflect what its future can be. And I think that that will happen. It just might, there will be death throes involved.
Well, yeah, because as we go to product locomotives as a business model, that is going to, there's only so many trains you can put on the track before it all derails. So I think that is the death throes you're talking about. You can sort of foresee that falling apart.
Right. And right now, films that could really make a mark have sometimes a problem being found through the information blizzard of Marvel movies that nobody needs being dropped onto thousands of screens. So, but you know, the law of diminishing returns is people are going to get to, not people, I mean, in the audience, this has happened a long time ago, but people in the industry are going to be desperate for things that are unique, that stand out. Oh, like art. Amazon, which is, you know, one of the supposed threats, right, to the future of cinema. Amazon, along with producer Ted Hope, they are literally trying to bring back the 90s indie film boom. They have signed deals with some of the best independent producers to bring cinematic works to the big screen and then exclusive distribution, obviously ancillary, distribution models through Amazon.
Right.
they
how about that?
They see this. So everywhere I look, there is hope for this. I had several movies to talk with you, but I mean, this brings us to pretty much the end of episode one of what I think is going to be a very interesting year for your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. Maybe 2 weeks hence, we'll do a big movie blitz episode where we talk about a whole lot of new movies, recent movies, and historic movies. What could be more fun than that?
I can't think of a thing.
Really? You can't even think of next week's episode as potentially being more fun? When we count down our top 10 all-time favorite live events.
That's going to be good.
Non-musical concert edition.
Right. Exactly. can't say the bands we saw.
Yeah. It's not live. It's all live events other than concerts, not musical concerts.
Right.
All other live events are in play. And that'll be next week's show. You can find every episode we've ever done, Dean Haglund, through 10 years and 1 week at chillpackhollywood.com. C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review after 11 years. Why not?
Yeah, let's see some new reviews. That would be fun. Write us.
Yeah.
Won't you? ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com. We want to hear from you. Like us on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Please like us. We're at facebook.com/ChillpackHollywood. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the same handy... what do we call that?
I don't know. I call it the handle.
A handle?
And a handle should be handy. Handle? So... Yeah.
That anyway. Sounds so CB radio.
Which makes it great.
Exactly. So we're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Maybe we should change it to @BreakerBreakerGoodBuddy. But for now, it's @Dean and Phil. All right. That's it, Chillpack Nation. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.